In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. This is episode 7 of our 8-part series on climate. We're digging into the biggest opportunities for founders and professionals in any industry to tackle our climate crisis. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Rachel Slabaugh, a nuclear expert and investor at DCVC, where she focuses on climate tech. Rachel was Associate Professor of Nuclear Engineering at UC Berkeley for 8 years, served as a Program Director at the Department of Energy's ARPA-E, and founded the Nuclear Innovation Bootcamp. She also serves as board chair of the Good Energy Collective, which she co-founded. She began her career, and I love this, as a nuclear reactor operator in University Park, Pennsylvania. In this episode, Rachel shares the biggest misunderstandings that people have about nuclear power, why we need it to solve the climate crisis, and the innovations she's most excited about. Dr. Slabaugh, thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So I have been looking forward to this conversation for a while because we've been hearing so much about nuclear power lately among recent guests on the show who see it as a clean energy solution. We've read a lot in the headlines about it in Europe, where it's being used as a solution when it comes to the reliance on Russian gas, or at least part of the conversation. But there's a ton of misinformation and I think a lot of fear about nuclear power. So just going to the basics, Rachel, what are the biggest misunderstandings people have about nuclear power?
Ooh, there are a lot.
What are the top three?
So there's a misconception that nuclear is not safe, while it is actually incredibly safe already. If you look at deaths per unit of electricity generated, wind and solar and nuclear are about equally safe, and they're all significantly safer than fossil fuels. A second misconception is that the waste is a problem that we can't solve. We actually have many technical solutions for the waste, and there are a bunch of policy and economic choices about what to do with the waste, but we do have technical solutions. And I would say the third is that nuclear is incredibly expensive. It is not inherently incredibly expensive. New nuclear plants are being built on time and on budget in countries that are good at building large complex projects. When I started in nuclear energy in the early 2000s, nuclear was actually the cheapest generation source that we had. So nuclear is not inherently expensive. There are just some challenges about how we build it in which economies.
Rachel, why is nuclear critical to solving the climate crisis?
Because it is a carbon-free, reliable, dispatchable source, it can be an integral part of the solution. Could you solve climate change without wind? Sure. Could you solve climate change without nuclear? Sure. Is it easier to solve it with all the tools in the tool belt? Yes.
That's well said. Yep.
Also, it has a very high capacity factor.
And by capacity factor, you mean like the percentage of the rated power that you'll actually get out of the system. So if we said it was a gigawatt system, if it's a 25% capacity factor, it would be a 250 megawatt system in terms of its actual output.
That's right. Nuclear is above 90% capacity factors. It's very reliable. And it actually requires a very small amount of resources. So it uses very few critical minerals. It uses very little like cement and steel and concrete per unit energy. It uses very little fuel. So when we're talking about really multiplying how much electricity we generate, it's a very efficient resource, which is helpful.
And for our listeners who don't know, what's the difference between fission and fusion?
So fission is where we take a large atom that is inherently unstable and we split it into two pieces. The split happens, you get two new atoms out and additional neutrons. Those neutrons can go on to cause more fission, so you can get a chain reaction. In fusion, you're sort of taking the opposite approach, where you're taking two light atoms and you're merging them together to make a larger atom. In both cases, what is actually happening is this, you've all heard of E equals MC squared. That's this very famous equation. What's happening is you're taking a little bit of mass and you're converting it into energy. And so what is kind of really cool and exciting about this is if you add up the atoms in the particles at the beginning of the reaction at the end, you have less mass because it was converted into energy. So we have fission right now. We've been making electricity with fission for decades. There are some challenges associated with fission that a bunch of advanced reactors are trying to address. Fusion is something where we can make fusion happen, but we have not yet gotten more energy out than it takes to cause the reaction. Fusion has some properties that can be better than fission. So it's considered the holy grail. It's not without its own challenges, but neither is any electricity source. So the goal is like, let's actually get fusion to produce energy and then eventually electricity.
Traditional reactors today are fission reactors, and they're either water reactors or modern reactors. Can you explain the difference there and maybe the difference in terms of the geographic scope of their applications in the world today?
So when we talk about existing reactors, we mean large light water reactors. And when we say water, it's just the water is the thing that cools the reactor. It provides the heat transfer mechanism. And by large, we mean about a gigawatt in scale. So a pretty significant electricity source. That's most of what we've built. It is what people are building globally. The other category of reactors that people are talking about are called advanced reactors. And that title contains a whole bunch of different options. In general, they are not cooled by water and or are smaller than a gigawatt. So we have micro reactors that are pretty small, like 1 to 10 megawatts. And we have what people call small modular reactors, and those are 50 to 350 megawatts. And in general, many of them use something besides water to transfer the heat.
And you say we have on the advanced reactors. Who is we and where are they actually deployed and live today?
Great question. So they're largely in development, and we is many startup companies and a few sort of big incumbents that have innovation arms internally. That said, China has just turned on their first advanced reactor. So there is one operating in China. It's a small gas reactor.
When I think about nuclear, a lot of people will point out that fuel costs can be low, but they still exist. So you still have this OPEX, CAPEX challenge. And for listeners who don't know, OPEX is the operating expense and CAPEX is the capital expense. It's the difference between running the system and building the system. I guess my challenge to you is how cheap can it become?
It can become pretty cheap. And it depends on, like, there are a lot of projections out there. And so until you actually build it and demonstrate it, a lot of people project a lot of things. So is 5 cents a watt achievable? Probably. There's like some compelling independently done studies showing why advanced reactors can hit those costs. Also, existing reactors that have their capital paid off also are pretty cheap, but the new ones are pretty capital intensive. And so for advanced reactors, a lot of what they're targeting is how do you start out with just having a lower capital cost to begin with? And so that makes it easier for more people to afford one to, you know, build it to begin with. You can get better loan rates, all that kind of thing. And you can use advanced manufacturing techniques. And so hopefully you actually have, you don't end up with like construction delays and all that kind of stuff. So most of what advanced reactors are targeting are addressing all of the issues that people have with existing nuclear, one of them being cost.
Nuclear facilities are known to be extremely stable in terms of their availability of output and supply or capacity factor. So how do we compare that? Or I guess on a cost basis, if we went all in on wind and solar plus storage, how do we think about that comparison?
There are many moving pieces. How cheap does storage become? How cheap does nuclear become, right? There are a lot of questions, but almost all studies, and there's a great paper by Jesse Jenkins in Joule that sort of lays this out, basically say up to about 70 to 80% renewables, you're doing pretty well. And it's that last 20 or 30% that it starts to become pretty expensive. We think of storage as I'm storing daytime to nighttime, or I have a cloudy week, but wind and solar vary on a seasonal scale. and we don't have great technologies that can store electricity for that kind of time, or that are make sense in a capital sense to actually build and barely use. And so that last sort of chunk, that's where nuclear really makes sense. And so does hydro, and so does geothermal. Like, these firm resources, everybody basically says it's cheaper, it's faster, and it's more efficient. We don't use as many materials. We don't have to mine as much stuff if we actually have something we can control.
So that's a great point. So basically, as we're filling up our journey to 100% zero carbon energy, as we get closer to that 80%, 90%, 100% range, that marginal addition of gigawatts of capacity gets much more complex when it's reliant on an intermittent resource.
That's right.
Yeah. Super helpful. So this is a super clean power source, zero carbon, zero emissions, except that we've got this waste issue, at least historically we have. So just on the advanced reactor side, what is being built in China and what could be built in the near future, how different is our waste profile from those types of systems?
The waste profile is in many ways different, mostly because the fuel forms are different. And we actually have a bunch of technical solutions of how to deal with nuclear waste. One of those solutions involves recycling, and advanced reactors actually offer a pathway to recycling because you need a particular type of reactor to burn up nuclear waste and get more energy out of it and make it radioactive for less time. And some of the advanced reactors do that. So if we decide we want to recycle, advanced reactors actually make that possible.
That's great. And another challenge people have had about nuclear power is the time frame to actual deployment, right? We are running out of time. We got to get a lot of work done in the next 8 years, this decade. And then we've got maybe another two where we have to be scaling the heck out of a lot of the work that we just did. So trying to project forward a little bit, if one reactor, one modern or advanced reactor has been built in China, in the next 5 years, what do you think is realistic? How many could be deployed and turned on?
Yeah, very few. I would look for much more deployment in the 2030s. And so it's less the how are we replacing fossil fuels? It's more of the how are we scaling, right? Because, like, let's keep in mind that over the next 30 years, we're projected to triple electricity production. We need a lot of technologies if we're going to triple electricity production. And we're going to increase it by 50% by 2030, right? So in the next few years, I would expect 5 to 10 micro reactors to be built, right? Enough to demonstrate them and start selling them. In the second half of the decade, we will have our first sort of medium-sized advanced reactors be demonstrated, and they'll be for sale. The larger ones will be for sale in the 2030s.
I know some people on the very small or micro scale have just talked about factory level production. And if we got to that ability, I don't think 20 years ago, people really visualized how many solar panels we could produce, or even how many wind turbines, which are maybe more akin to this more complex and massive machinery. And yet we have been banging them out and getting them in all corners of the planet. It's just we've been so slow on nuclear build out for a while that it is just difficult to reimagine that kind of speed of scale and production.
Yeah. But if you think about, like, if you have a 1.5 megawatt nuclear reactor that you can get delivered in a shipping container, it changes how we think about it. And that's sort of what's exciting. And many of these, especially the micro reactors, are being designed where they don't need any water cooling. They can just use an air heat sink. And so again, now you're sort of free from a lot of the traditional constraints of nuclear reactors.
We were talking about two types of fission facilities, but there's also this fusion thing, which is one of those, like, you know, the technology of tomorrow, 5 years away for like the last 30 or 40 years.
So why fusion is sort of having its moment in the sun, maybe, is in the last 10 years, maybe a little longer, there's been a bit of a pivot. There have always been sort of some other hot fusion concepts that people were working on, but they didn't really have any funding. Both government funding and now private funding have come in. Right next to that, you know, material science has gotten better. Computing has gotten better. There have been sort of a background of technical development combined with some recent strategic investment that has finally allowed some progress to be made. And I would expect that this decade, we will see fusion actually make more energy than it takes to cause the fusion, which is, of course, step one to actually making electricity.
Okay, so this has been the magical moment or potential magical moment for fusion where we get more energy out than we put in. And I just want to clarify, lines like that sound very straightforward, simplistic. That sounds like a pretty, wow, that, and then like the perpetual motion machine gets moving and then we can just infinitely make infinite power right away. And I know that's not exactly the case. So is it an all-in cost comparison now creates more energy and benefit coming out? Is it a money thing or just an energy thing?
It's just an energy thing. We're like not talking money yet. So it's like, can I get a megawatt of energy out after putting a megawatt of energy in? And that's called break even. And we have not yet accomplished that. And then once you get to break even, you need something like a multiple between 3 and 10 to get an actual device that makes any sense.
Right. So if the first stage, we would be thrilled if you got like 1% more power out, like break even, better than break even just means like a point of a percent or something, you know, basis point. And that's a win. And then you're saying, but you actually have to get like 5 times more energy or 10 times more energy out for the economics to start working.
That's right. Because otherwise, if you're just like creating as much energy as you're using, it doesn't get you anywhere.
So is that progression from the basis point above the break-even point where we can all high five, and I'm sure like people in CERN and other places will all be like popping champagne. That'll be a great scientific moment. But is the distance between that and the 5X and the 10X, is that a linear projection? Because that feels like that could be a super long wait.
Yeah, it is not linear. And the good news is the way the physics inflection work, as far as we know, right? We've never been there, so we have to make sure it's real. We're on sort of the inflection point of an upward curve. So it should be faster and it should be significantly easier. I would expect to see break even and maybe energy multiples this decade. I wouldn't expect to see power plants until next decade. So the hypothesis of why you would invest in a fusion company is that it may be enough to go public by hitting break even and by hitting energy multiple and showing you have a trajectory. And there is some public appetite for companies that are doing those kinds of like really scientifically impressive things that will eventually become really productive. And so the bet in fusion is picking the couple of companies that are going to hit the marks first, and that should be enough to get them public.
Escape velocity, as it were. You founded something called the Nuclear Innovation Bootcamp. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that. And in addition to these, like, hey, let's go build a different type of reactor business models, are you seeing other sort of innovative venture fundable business models that in nuclear that are sort of ancillary related? Are there other areas that are investable?
I'll start with the bootcamp. So it is a 2-week program sort of modeled after a regular startup bootcamp. And the idea came from sort of two things. I grew up in Pennsylvania, went to school in the Midwest, did not in any way consider myself associated with innovation or startups. And I moved to the Bay Area, and then all of a sudden I learned a lot about startups and how it works just from sort of being around humans here. And at the same time, the nuclear ecosystem started to have a little bit of innovation in startups. And I got pulled into a conversation of how do we support these nascent startups? How do we support this ecosystem? And I was like, well, most students in nuclear are in the Midwest, in these places that don't necessarily have as strong of ecosystems. So why don't we bring them to the Bay Area and talk about all the non-technical things that you actually need for commercialization? And so that's where the bootcamp started. We bring students from around the world from different backgrounds to build interdisciplinary teams. They do group design projects and have a pitch competition in the end, and they learn about energy markets and licensing and finance and all this stuff.
Amazing. And what kinds of surprising innovations have you seen come out of it that could turn into real companies?
Yeah, so we've had a couple of companies start, but really a lot of it is just people starting to think about, in many ways, some of what you said, okay, we don't necessarily need a million more reactor designs. What are the other things that we need? Oh, maybe we actually need better digitization. Maybe we can do better information sharing. We occasionally get like nonprofit ed tech startups. We've had a waste startup, people thinking about like, what if we powered maritime shipping with nuclear, some alternative uses. So a lot of what the students are thinking about are like, how can we expand the market? What are services these advanced plants will need? Those kinds of things.
And I mean, one of the other great things about that to me feels like, I know people who come out of nuclear training in the Navy or just schools and the labs, and they tend to be more conservative, very technical, much more conservative, and maybe risk averse in some ways as part of the professional requirement. But I would imagine you're also pulling people a little bit out of that mindset and into more of a, let's go try new things. Let's go do something fun and exciting. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing people ready to take entrepreneurial leaps?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of, how do we design things in a way that we can actually do design, build, test? How do we iterate more rapidly? How do we get fast learning? And so even in the, you know, nuclear reactor design companies, doing more hardware in the loop, really using simulation strategically and focusing on learning rapidly in a way that I think wasn't, I mean, at the beginning of nuclear, just like, nobody really thought about why you would even need to do that. And now it's really clear we need to be nimble and strategic and efficient.
Awesome. I think a lot of listeners are people trying to figure out what's their point of entry into the climate side of the startup world. And I think what you're sharing is that there's a renaissance going on in nuclear power, even at the early stages, and there's a lot of different types of work and jobs to be done. So people who have the passion, either from their educational background or from time spent in the military or other areas, there's plenty of work out there to get started, and it's very exciting. Can we do a little lightning round? I have a bunch of quick questions I want to ask you. First one is Diablo Canyon in California, last remaining nuclear plant. Should it stay open?
Keep it open. Replacing a gigawatt of clean electricity is not an extra lift that we need to be doing.
Excellent. France. Is France the smartest country on the planet when it comes to nuclear power?
They're pretty smart.
Excellent. After Vogtle, that disaster of a concrete pit in Georgia, what year will America turn on its next nuclear facility? Could be micro up to macro.
2024.
Really? Do you have a name for that facility? Is it like somewhere on a map already?
Well, I mean, there's a demonstration micro reactor at Idaho.
Okay. Is there a different one that's like commercially operable by 2024?
So I think 2025, you will probably see a micro reactor that is a commercial, like putting electrons on the grid, potentially from Oklo, potentially from Radiant Nuclear, potentially from UltraSafe Nuclear. Those are the people moving pretty fast.
Excellent. Do you think ocean-based nuclear facilities are a good idea that are like floating on a boat or a pier or something?
So I've researched them very little, but in principle, it makes sense.
Okay. And finally, when will Vogtle turn on in Georgia?
Oh man, I've not kept up with this. I don't know. Probably in 2 more years.
Okay, great. And Rachel, we always close the show with the following question. In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. Come 2030, what are we going to look back on as an obvious idea that today seemed totally crazy?
This is maybe a cop-out, but it is the frame I'm trying to push. Clean energy is not an either or, it is a yes and.
So you're basically nuclear plus wind plus hydro plus solar plus storage is the new all of the above, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of the energy sources being like, I'm better than this other one for this reason. It's like, no. Fossil fuels polluting the environment and killing people. We just need all the clean energy.
Right. We've got some basic existential things to take care of. I have been so looking forward to this conversation because honestly, I've never been like a hater on the nuclear side, but I've been a little bit silent on it. And you've really helped change my frame and my perspective. And I think I'm coming over to the new all of the above mantra. So thank you for that.
Great. Thanks for being willing to listen.
That was Dr. Rachel Slabaugh. nuclear expert and investor at DCVC. Next week on the show, we speak with Kathy Zoy, CEO of EVgo.
Now, our standard configuration is 350 kilowatts. That's faster. That's more powerful than any light-duty vehicle can actually take a charge right now. But we're doing the Wayne Gretzky thing and skating ahead of the puck because we know those higher power cars are coming.
Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lusby, and Jason Mack. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.